From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1873, when Susan B. Anthony was on trial. Her crime, of course, was voting. Anthony was taking the opportunity to discuss women's suffrage in various venues in those days, including a historic building that I suspect you, if you're like me, you don't know much about it. And that's why I'm so excited about this hour. The building is the 1816 Farmington Quaker Meeting House. The building still exists 200 years later. It's one of the earliest and largest meeting houses west of the colonial settlement line, and it became a common place for men and women to debate, discuss issues of the day. We're talking the movement to protect Native American sovereignty. It found its way to the meeting house. Women's rights, of course. The Underground Railroad and abolitionism. We're coming up on a significant celebration, the bicentennial on October 22nd and 23rd. The building was saved, essentially, by a group of devoted citizens, and it's being restored. And we've got a lot to talk about the history and what happens next there. So it's kind of a tour through history and a look at what's going on site, what's coming up on the 22nd and 23rd. And let me go ahead and welcome our guests. Lyle Jenks is the president of the 1816 Farmington Quaker Meeting House Museum. I know it's an exciting time for you. And so I just wanted to say welcome. And also, I apologize for my ignorance on this. I'm going to ask a lot of ignorant questions this hour, but Judy just said yay.
There's no ignorant question. We hope that listeners will understand more of why we're so excited about this project as the hour goes on.
No ignorant questions, just ignorant people who ask those questions. Dr. Judy Wellman's a professor emeritus of history at SUNY Oswego. She's on the board. She's been someone I think has written extensively about the meeting house, and thank you for taking the time to be here. I look forward to the conversation this hour.
It's wonderful to be here, and thank you for having us. WXXI's got a long tradition of supporting these local sites and historic movements. We're really pleased. Thank you.
I will say, when Judy's name hit the guest list this morning, there were several people in the building who were very excited, who've known you and your work in the past. So thanks for being here. Ronnie Ryder's here, and Ronnie is with the Gunnonagan State Historic Site. Ronnie, welcome to you. Thanks for being here. And Meg Joseph is the executive director of Friends of Gunnonagan. Meg, welcome to you as well. I'm going to roll that mic a little bit closer to you, that way I can hear you better. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. So, Lyle, I'm going to start with you. For listeners who've never been there or don't know exactly where we're talking about, where are we talking about here?
We're talking about the Farmington Township, mm-hmm. just 20 or so miles from where we are in the studios of WXXI now. It's just south of the Wayne, Ontario County line, and our building is at the corner of Sheldon Road and County Road 8 in what's now a historic district, very close to what has been known over the centuries as the hamlet of Pumpkin Hook.
Very good. And so 10 years ago, Windstorm took a wall off. Is that right?
It did, and the whole building was endangered. Mm-hmm. As a matter of public safety, the town of Farmington asked or required the current owner of the property to demolish the building. It was very close to the road and was a hazard to public safety. That was when Judy and many members of the Farmington Friends Church, a local active congregation, and others in the Farmington Macedon community said, no, this is much too important to lose. We must save this for posterity, not because it's an old barn that's falling down, but because of all the important events that have happened here that we want future generations to know about as well.
Sure. I remarked actually in the opening of the hour, if you drive throughout the Finger Lakes region, there are so many beautiful old structures. There's beautiful old barns that are sort of caving in, and you see them, and you think, oh, that's beautiful. I wonder if that could be restored. But this is really special. So, Judy, let's do a little history here. So it's the 1816 meeting house, built in 1816, and simple, but, you know, kind of give me a sense for the size of it and how it was used, especially in those earlier years.
Well, we think it was probably the largest building west of the settlement line before the Erie Canal. So it was a huge building for then. It is about 42, 44 feet by 60 feet. And it's two stories it had galleries on top and a third story kind of an attic. So it was a very large building. People say it could hold 1,000 people. And it was built that way because there were so many Quakers coming into Western New York. Some of you may know Jemima Wilkinson, the public universal friend, as she called herself, who was a Quaker, the first one to settle in this area. She bought the land from some of these Farmington friends who came in 1789. But they just attracted people, and eventually they were the site of a yearly meeting in Quaker terminology. They would come together from 25 monthly meetings around Western New York, Canada, Michigan, one in Pennsylvania, all over the region. So there would be hundreds of people there in Farmington at Genesee Yearly Meeting every June, and that's why it had to be so big. There were 1,000 people listed in Farmington as Quakers in 1828, even just the little area around there. So it was it needed to be big.
And I mentioned Susan B. Anthony, just one example. But 1873, you know, give me a sense for the history there. If she is going to be there in 1873, she is she making a public presentation? Is the gallery listening? Is there dialogue? What's the event like?
You all know Susan B. voted in November 1872. She went home and she wrote in triumph to her friend Elizabeth Cady Stanton. She says, "Well, I've gone and done it. Positively voted the straight Republican ticket," which always gets a big laugh in rural upstate New York communities because they still are. But they're Lincoln Republicans. That's why it's a tradition here. And so she was going to be tried in Monroe County. And the trial was rigged, and they wanted the result that she would be convicted. But she said, "I'm going to go around," and she went with Matilda Jocelyn Gage to every town in Monroe County, and they talked about the importance of women's right to vote. And it's a basic issue that we still confront today. People cannot vote. People are excluded from voting, all this gerrymandering, et cetera. That's why it's such an important issue. It's not dead. And so they moved the trial to Canandaigua, so they thought they'd have a jury that could be more manipulated. So she and Matilda Jocelyn Gage did the very same thing. She had family. Her parents went to Farmington on their honeymoon, so they were Quakers affiliated with that meeting. They had all kinds of relatives there. She went to the Farmington Meeting House in 1873 in May. On one of these, she gave a speech, which we have available, about the right of women to vote as a way to generate support and interest for her cause. It didn't make any difference because it was a rigged trial in any case. But they certainly, I mean, talk about perseverance.
Mm-hmm. So there's just one little slice of history, but Ronnie Ryder, for you, what stands out about the Quaker Meeting House and its place in history, especially for listeners who are hearing about this structure? Again, like me, very ignorant of what has happened there throughout the years.
Well, because the Quakers sort of interceded for the Senecas during the treaties, the Treaty of 1830 and 1842, it was the Seneca women that did not want to make the move to Kansas. And so they asked the Quakers to kind of, on their benefit, intercede for them with the government. And so the role of our women throughout history is that our women are behind the chiefs. And they're the ones that have elected the chiefs, put them into their positions. And our women have always had a strong voice within our governments.
Is that a part of, let me just back up and say, I think in American history, the women's role is sometimes erased or diminished. But in Seneca history, is that also the case, that it's less well known?
It's probably less well known. Mm-hmm. I was in Pennsylvania last week, and people don't even know who the Haudenosaunee people mm-hmm. are. Mm-hmm. But that is a big part of our history, and it's important. And that's something that I tell our visitors at Ganondagan is, you know, the suffragette movement celebrations coming up next year in 2017. But for Haudenosaunee clan mothers and leaders, our women have had a voice dating back to the beginning of the formation of the Confederacy.
So Meg Joseph, for you, what is the significance of the structure we're talking about today, the museum, the history on that site?
So one of the things for Friends of Ganondagan is we do the programming that supports Ganondagan State Historic Site that really tells the story of the Seneca and the Haudenosaunee people. And over the past years, we've partnered with the Quaker Meeting House to put together...
That's okay. I'm just going to grab that mic a little closer. Go ahead, Meg.
To do programming that really reflects how we both... promote the message of peace and have always promoted the message of social justice. So it's really where our two organizations come together to really promote peace and to show, in particular, people who are contemporary that that share the same common values. So that's why we're excited about their 200th anniversary. You know, we have folks that have common interests, you know, such as Frida Jock, who is an Onondaga clan mother, who we've also had speak at Ganondagan. Sally Roche Wagner is going to be there, who is the executive director of the Matilda Jocelyn Gage House. And also, I think they're very excited about the fact that Mona Polacco, who is one of the 13 indigenous grandmothers, is going to be there on Sunday, and then she's going to come back to Ganondagan and have a special, you know, a kind of time there with the folks, you know, at Ganondagan and some of the Haudenosaunee people there. So,
all right. So you want to see more of what this looks like, and I know there's a website. Lyle, what's the website for people to check out?
Our website is farmingtonmeetinghouse.org, www.farmingtonmeetinghouse.org. And posted on our website is the detailed schedule of our events for the 22nd and 23rd. One of the exciting things for the many volunteers who've planned this weekend, co-sponsored by Friends of Ganondagan, the Town of Farmington, Farmington Friends Church, and one other group, the Elizabeth Cady Stanton Foundation. We haven't talked quite as much about that, but we've partnered with that group in the purchase and the stabilization of the building. We'll have several portrayers on the grounds on Saturday in particular, friends from the Susan B. Anthony House will be there in costume. Susan B. Anthony, in the person of Barbara Blaisdell, will be saying some of what Susan B. Anthony said in 1873 to bring that part of history back together. We will have others portraying Frederick Douglass, Austin Stewart, who was one of the very first residents of Farmington who came on the Underground Railroad, and we think probably helped build the Farmington Meeting House in 1816 and 17. Elizabeth Cady Stanton will be there, as will Lucretia Mott, who traveled from Philadelphia with her husband James Mott almost every summer for the yearly meeting sessions at Farmington, which Judy mentioned a few moments ago.
As will Ronnie.
Yes. Friends of Ganondagan will be present all through the weekend, and we're looking forward to the traditional Seneca Thanksgiving address as part of our opening ceremonies on Saturday.
Saturday the 22nd, and it starts what time?
The grounds open at 10 o'clock. Our opening ceremonies begin at 11 with the Thanksgiving address and introduction of local dignitaries and visitors from near and far.
Ronnie, you want to give us a little preview on what you're going to be talking about?
I'm probably going to be, in a way, educating the public about the role of the women and how they influenced the treaties regarding Buffalo Creek and the Cattaraugus reservations.
Very good. Well, if you, Lyle promised that he's not going to poke fun at me for ignorant questions. So if you haven't been out there like me, how's it looking now? And it's not exactly in the same spot after that windstorm. It's moved a little bit from the original place. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. It has. A few years ago, with a whole lot of effort and a whole lot of excitement and holding of breath, we watched the building slowly move from the location where it had been since it ceased being a meeting house in the 1920s, across the intersection.
You moved it intact?
Yes.
Across the intersection.
Right. Under the utility wires, it was quite an experience. It moved very slowly on these.
How nervous were you, Lyle?
I was mostly nervous for one of our local friends at age 80 plus, maybe almost 90, who sat right in front of the building and watched it come toward her, and then she would back up a few feet until it got closer to her. We were all just captivated. That was a few years ago, and the building is now on a new foundation with new pillars. It has been buttoned up with temporary siding to prevent any further deterioration until our fundraising efforts move forward enough that we can continue with restoration of the building. The sixth of the six bays, the one that blew off in the windstorm a few years ago, is pretty much intact in pieces in the attic. It's going to be like a big Lincoln Log project to pull those pieces out and figure out how they get fit back together to replace that end of the building. We'll have to do some replacement, but the architects who've worked with us and are producing the historic structure report for us say that almost 90% of the original materials are on site and can be put back together.
You know, so Lyle, I wanted to ask you about this question of moving it and preserving as much as you can. And my mind goes to, for example, the Chautauqua Amphitheater at the institution, where there was a really, I think in many ways, some contentious community debates about, can we save that structure and improve it without tearing it down? Or do we tear it down and build a replica as close as we can? And it was emotional for a lot of people. And I was really moved by some of the arguments made by the Landmark Society of Western New York, the YUPS, the Young Urban Preservationists, who always appreciate when you can save that initial structure. But did it occur to you, Judy, did it occur to you that, you know, maybe we just rebuild this meeting house as best we can with new materials? Or kind of give me a sense for why you wanted that structure preserved.
Because it was a place of worship for 100 years before it was turned into a celery and potato barn and later a chicken coop. Just a quick aside, the first time I went in the building was when a high school classmate of mine said, Lyle, you're mixed up with the Quakers now. You might be interested in the old barn that's on the farm. I'm getting ready to sell the farm, but go in and take a look. And I went in and took a look, and it gave me shivers. I said to myself, this chicken wire that's protecting the hens from jumping from the gallery down onto the facing benches, the front part of the main floor, that's got to come down. We've got to put back the broken stairway that I scrambled up on all 4 feet to get there. I was living and working in Philadelphia at that time and was sent as a member of a granting group to come and do a field visit at the site for a potential grant to help with the initial restoration of the building. And I met with Judy and the local volunteers who were committed to this, went back and reported to the granting group. They looked at the pictures, laughed, and said, Lyle, get a life. It's time for the bulldozers. I said, wait a minute, folks. I've met with this group in Farmington, and if you could see the spark in their eye the way I did, you would know that this is an appropriate and worthy preservation project. It's going to be phenomenal as a restoration of the original building rather than a rebuild.
Well, before I get to some phone calls, because the phone's been ringing and our community wants to join the discussion, so please, if you're on the line, we're coming to you in just a second. The full update then is you need to raise how much? And the best case scenario is what, Lyle?
The architects who are working with us on the historic structure report are giving us a ballpark estimate at this point of $1.5 million to rebuild the part that was blown off in the windstorm and restore the building so that it can be open to the public as a museum a living museum, one of the decisions we need to make is whether we can restore the entire building or restore one half of it, like most Quaker meeting houses of the era. It was totally symmetrical. There are two doors, one for the women's side, one for the men's side, when there were separate business sessions. We're thinking about perhaps restoring one half of it for contemporary use and leaving the other half more or less in its current state for those who are studying historic preservation and restoration to come and see a before and after mm-hmm. kind of project. That's a decision that we need to make. But a $100,000 check from anyone who has it would be wonderful. Yay. It will add up to $1.5 million to supplement the historic preservation grants, which we've already received for the initial phases.
Listeners, here we come to your phone calls. I'll let you know again, though. You want to check out the full schedule of events for October 22nd and 23rd as they celebrate 200 years. It's farmingtonmeetinghouse.org. And if you want to be Lyle's best friend and write that $100,000 check, you can find that contact information there. There's a lot to learn there. And there's history there, some photographs. I want to see more. I'm seeing more in this brochure here. And let me start with Parrish in East Rochester. Go ahead, Parrish.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm calling partly because I am a descendant of Lucretia Mott and also of her sister Martha Wright, because their kids married each other. Mm-hmm. I moved to Rochester about 30 years ago, and at the time I didn't think I had any connection to the city. But it turned out that I have ancestors buried in Mount Hope Cemetery. The parents of James Mott, the husband of Lucretia Mott, are buried at Mount Hope Cemetery. Mm-hmm. And the reason they're buried there is because James Mott's two sisters moved with their husbands to this area in the 1820s. One of them was Silas Cornell, who was the city surveyor and laid out the cemetery. But when they first moved to the area, they moved to Farmington, because I guess if you moved up from downstate and you were a Quaker, that was the place that attracted you. So I'm curious to know if the restoration is going to be a complete, if the goal ultimately is to be a complete restoration, and I've seen pictures of the building with a porch around the outside. Is that going to be in the ultimate design for restoration?
First, we'd love to have your contact information and invite you to come out. This is wonderful that you're here. And we do know quite a lot about that family. We have a researcher who's got like 15,000 names of people associated with the Farmington Quaker Meeting House in a big database. Yeah. So we're still debating that. The earliest picture we have, no, not the earliest one, but the earliest ones we have are from the 1880s. Maybe 70s, and they have the porch on. It was put on in 1863 when they received a big grant from someone's will. And it was not there when most of the active work took place in the movements that changed America for Native American rights, African American rights, women's rights. So we're thinking about leaving off the porch. So if you have thoughts, you can send them in. We'd love to hear.
Okay, I hope to be there for the bicentennial. I want to mention about, since this is called, the show is called Connections, that in 1848, Lucretia Mott almost certainly visited the Farmington meeting on her way from visiting a Native American project where Quakers were helping Haudenosaunee tribal members along the shores of Lake Erie to learn quote-unquote modern farming techniques. And then after that, she went up to visit escaped slaves near Hamilton, Ontario, and then continued on her trip towards Seneca Falls, where she was going to meet her friend Elizabeth Cady Stanton. So as she passed through this area, she undoubtedly stopped at the Farmington meeting.
That's right. We think that Lucretia Mott visited in Farmington almost every year for a number of years during that era. Mm-hmm. The summary of her activities that you just mentioned, we refer to as what Lucretia Mott did on her summer vacation. and more about that later in the hour as we see our primary goal, not just educating, but challenging and encouraging visitors to the meeting house to think, what might I do? Mm-hmm. What is my role? How might I let my life speak as Mott and the Native Americans and Susan B. Anthony and Frederick Douglass and so many others let us know what they were called to do in their time.
Mott also visited Auburn prisoners at that time, too. So it's those are themes that we carry out both in historic terms and in all of our program. We try to connect it with what's going on now, and we do ask that very question. What are we doing on these issues about equal rights? So it's a very positive place to come because it's people who worked for equal rights for all people, and it's gathering us together who think that's an important mm-hmm. concept. The Declaration of Independence says all men are created equal, and we still argue about what that means, but come and help us figure it out.
Well, Parrish, are you all square with getting in touch if you need to before I let you go?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time to call the program, Parrish, and share your family background and your stories. I appreciate that.
Thank you for having me.
Parrish in East Rochester. I was going to take our break, but I think I have to take our line two caller because, to Judy's point there, the question on what happens now, what's the legacy of the meeting house, what does it inform us about opportunities we have for impacting change? Sam in Rochester is concerned about voting rights today as well. Go ahead, Sam.
I thank you for celebrating Susan B. Anthony and her voting rights. But, and you know, when you celebrate something, it's there to stay. But as you know, the Voting Rights Act, which was passed, is not there to stay because we have to go and fight for it every year in order for it to stay. And when you have the voting rights, look at the things that they have implemented to keep people from voting by asking for IDs and cutting back on the days in which you can vote. Instead of doing that, they should be further trying to find ways to open it up so more people can vote. And, I mean, that would be a program that I would love to hear you have in the future, maybe, as to how you have to keep fighting for your voting rights and the things that they're trying to implement to keep people from voting. Since the struggle was so great to get to where we are today, mm-hmm. where everyone can vote and have that right to vote.
Sam, it's well said. Judy, what do you think?
Thank you so much for saying that. That's exactly why we're thinking about this, and it's exactly why this is important. And we all know what's going on with the Voting Rights Act, and we all need to be putting our shoulder to the wheel to think about what we're going to do about that. One of the people who's coming on Sunday at 12:30 is Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, who is chair of the Centennial of the Woman Suffrage in New York State, which was 1917. And we're hoping that we can make connections with exactly that, with people who are working on voting rights today. She has pointed out that only 46% of New York State citizens vote today, which is an appalling figure. So we're hoping to use that centennial celebration as a way to reach out and think about what we're doing about voting rights for all people, including African Americans, all people of color, poor people, women, my neighbors who often don't vote because in order to vote in New York State, you have to register by this Friday. It's 3 weeks from the election. A lot of people will not get the paperwork and won't do it. So it's a live issue, and it's the basis of democracy around the world. It's the basis of who gets to say what you're doing about your life. And so right on.
Thank you, Sam.
But, I would also say, too, that you said about 46% of people in New York State don't vote. I would say about 25% of those people would be Jehovah Witnesses, because Jehovah Witnesses, they don't vote. They say they don't engage in things that are man-made. But there's nothing that you can do today that's not man-made. So I don't understand their philosophy there when they don't vote.
Well, Sam, I appreciate the call and for the reminder that a lot of these struggles that complacency is something to I think, be on guard against. I think about what we can do today. Sam's talking voting rights, protection of rights. I got into a bit of a tangle on social media this week about Native American symbols. I'm from Cleveland, so I'm a Cleveland Indians fan, and my Indians are in the American League Championship Series. And I said, wouldn't it be great if our organization, with everyone watching, said, we're done with Chief Wahoo. We're taking this symbology off. We're done with it. I would love to see them change the name of the team. And, of course, I had a number of people online push back and say, you know, hey, white man, you don't speak for Native people. The Washington Post polled this in May, and their poll found that 90% of Native Americans don't even care about the name Redskins, and I know there's been pushback on that. So it just got me thinking, and I thought of the conversation I had with Michael Galvin earlier this year and his remarkable story of growing up as an Irondequoit student and feeling sort of this lonely caricature that happens to so many of our Native American brothers and sisters when we don't treat them as human beings. We think of them as mascots. And Tim on Twitter wrote to me and said, we could probably do even more, Evan. A very public debate about how our government has not honored its treaties might lead to a change of the mascots. But I don't have the expertise there, but I thought, time for me to get studying. What do you think of that, Ronnie?
Well, for me, this is pretty apropos. I grew up in Western New York. I attended Iroquois Central School. Our mascot was the Iroquois Chiefs and still remains that way. Mm-hmm. Before we could even form a letter-writing campaign of alumni, the board made a decision to stay with the Iroquois Chiefs, just flat across the board.
Without even consulting, without talking?
They did get a few letters, but before it could really be organized into a rally and a letter-writing campaign, the decision was made and posted. So being at Ganondagan years ago, we were invited to go to Irondequoit and to go to Penfield. And a lot of times we still get these questions from schools that will call in and ask, what is your opinion, or can you come and talk to us? And to me, it's astounding that people would ask us what our opinion is and how we're feeling and then turn around and say, it doesn't matter. We shouldn't change it. It's always been like that. It's not. It's a way to honor Native Americans. And when you sat there and asked us, and we said, no, we don't feel honored by it, to me, that's very astounding. I guess that's the only word I can say at this point.
And what about Tim's comment that, you know, we could use this as a moment to have a public conversation about how our government has not honored its treaties?
Ooh. I attend the Canandaigua Treaty Commemoration every year on November 11th. I feel that it's extremely important to bring this to the attention of the local people in this area. Those treaties, we've been told, are old and invalid. The Declaration of Independence is old. I don't say it's invalid. I'm not going to tell you your government is invalid. But those treaties were signed by both nations, the Haudenosaunee people and the people of the United States, and they need to be honored. They didn't expire. There was no expiration date on them. So they are still valid.
If people wanted to learn more, are there easy resources to try to get a good history lesson on that treaty, for example?
You can come to Ganondagan.
Yeah, come to Ganondagan.
Absolutely.
Meg?
Well, you can come to Canandaigua Treaty Day Commemoration on November 11th. It's at, begins about 10 in the morning, but the big part of the day starts at 2 o'clock. It's at the Rock in Canandaigua at the
courthouse.
At the courthouse. But it's in the Canandaigua Primary School. We have a keynote speaker. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I see as a big parallel too is what's going on, you know, with the Sioux Nation right now. We are going to have, somebody who has been there, who has been taking pictures and who has been reporting there, come and share what he has learned and really talk about how, you know, Canandaigua tree is one of the very few trees that, you know, is still, you know, in existence. And the whole idea is to polish the change. So to keep that treaty alive, and the Quakers, there will be a representative from the Quakers, you know, they were involved and to ensure that things were done, you know, right and legally. And so, you know, that day is really a day full of learning. And you can go to our website, Canandaigan.org, and there's more information on the Canandaigua Treaty there as well.
Treaty Day is November 11th, is that right? We need a program on this. So, producer Megan Mack, let's talk afterwards. Let's make sure before that happens, because we should let people know. So, make sure we don't leave without setting that up. I apologize for my ignorance as well on this, but thank you for at least filling in some of the gaps. I know we are way late for our only break of the hour. Let's get that break, and we're going to come back with our guest. You just heard Meg Joseph, who is the executive director of Friends of Canandaigan, and Ronnie Ryder, who is with Canandaigan State Historic Site. Lyle Jenks is president of the 1816 Farmington Quaker Meeting House Museum. And Dr. Judy Wellman is here, Professor Emeritus of History at SUNY Oswego. She's on the board, and they're helping us understand the history that is all around us, especially in this remarkable building that so many of us have never seen and never been to. Maybe that'll change. We'll get right back to that conversation next. I'm Evan Dawson, Thursday on The Next Connections. Think about some of the most famous campaign photos of all time. Michael Dukakis wearing the helmet and the tank. John Kerry windsurfing. There's plenty of others. We're going to talk about campaign photography. When is it fair? When does it distort? What is its role? Then in our second hour, John Stewart says we need to bring back the draft for national public service. Is it a good idea? Talk to you then. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. In our brief break, Dr. Judy Wellman was telling us about the Treaty of Buffalo Creek as well, something we should know about?
Yes, in 1838. You may know the tragic story of the Cherokee who went on a trail of tears in the summer of 1838 because the federal government used their Indian Removal Act. Their idea was to remove every single Native person east of the Mississippi to west of the Mississippi. They did it with the Cherokee. 8,000 people died on that trip. The Senecas were so aware, all the Haudenosaunee people were so aware of what had happened, and the federal government was so happy with what they had done that they said to the negotiator, who was from upstate New York, Schenectady, go to New York State, make the same deal with the Haudenosaunee people, and we're going to send them to Kansas and Oklahoma. The Senecas said, no, you're not. We're not leaving. We are not leaving. 15-6, they did a census. They asked every Seneca man, every Seneca woman, do you want to go? Do you not want to go? 15/16 of the Seneca people said, we're not leaving. We're staying right here. And they came to Farmington Meeting in 1840, a lot of Seneca people, and they said, can you help us? So the Quakers organized a whole national campaign of letter writing, of pamphlets, of interviews, of petitions, and of help. So they had ended up with a supplementary treaty, they called it, of 1842, and which allowed Allegheny and Cattaraugus people to stay. Tonawanda, they lost. The Tonawanda people said, it's tough, we're not leaving anyway, and they made a separate deal in 1857. So, you know, a lot of people look at Quakers and they say, are you still here? You say, oh, yeah, we're still here. Well, I think a lot of people look at Seneca people and they say, are you still here? And you say, yeah, we're still here.
We're still here.
Because of what happened in these historic occasions.
And we have survived. And at that time, the Buffalo Creek reservation was disposed of, basically. And that's why they were saying send them to Kansas. But it was the women that definitely did not want to make that move. And so our people were moving to Cattaraugus and Allegheny and Oil Springs. The Tonawandas were able to buy back most of their reservation area.
Well, let me turn the conversation toward African-American rights as well. Sam brought that up, and I think it's important that we understand the history at the 1816 Farmington Quaker Meeting House. And you quote a couple of people throughout history. Well, everyone knows Frederick Douglass. I know he spoke at the 1816 Farmington Quaker Meeting House. He attended the Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls in 1848. But there are so many other stories of freedom seekers. You have Austin Stewart from 22 years a slave and 40 years a free man in 1857, writing, quote, "When I arrived in Farmington, I felt for the first time in my life that I was my own master. I cannot describe to a free man what a proud and manly feeling came over me. When I hired to Mr. C, nor when I assumed the dignity of collecting my own earnings." That's Austin Stewart. So, Judy, why don't you kind of give me a sense for just how significant this meeting house was in African-American rights?
I'll have to talk really, really, really fast because there's so much material, so I won't cover it all. But obviously, Frederick Douglass was strongly affiliated with these Quakers. He spoke in these areas all over and all over these small towns. And he said, "I'd speak on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I'd come back on Thursday to Rochester. I'd write it up and I'd put it as my editorial in the North Star on Friday." So it's a very, his voice, his national voice, his international voice is shaped by these conversations. And William Wells Brown, who was the first African-American novelist who wrote a play, his novel was called Clotel or the President's Daughter. It was patterned after Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson. Could you believe that? He came to Farmington, he escaped from slavery, went to Buffalo, came to Farmington in 1840, wrote his autobiography there. Then he went to England and became a major international figure, and he's a Farmington person affiliated with Farmington. The Edmondson sisters, who escaped from a dramatic story of trying to escape from Washington, D.C. on a ship called the Pearl in April 1848. It was becalmed. Every 77 African-Americans aboard were captured, sold into slavery, including these two young girls, like 14 and 16 sisters. Their father was so distraught, he came north and went to mostly African-American churches, but also Henry Ward Beecher's Plymouth Church in New York City, raised $2,400 to get them out of slavery. Until we started the Farmington Project, we had no idea they went directly to Farmington, where these Quaker women set up a school that was a biracial school to help these girls who wanted to become teachers, and one of them died and one of them did become a teacher, went to Washington, D.C. to work with African American people. I mean, it just seems like the ripples go out from this place all over the country in so many ways. And Austin Stewart's obviously one of the most famous residents of Farmington. He's became a grocer in Rochester, went to a black community, the Dawn community in Canada, and ended up in Canandaigua, where he's buried.
So you're just scratching the surface there, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. How did I do?
Lyle's smiling.
There's,
you want to
so
add something
much.
There?
There is so much. A few minutes ago, Evan, you asked about resources that would be available for those who want to learn more about the treaties for Native American land rights and such. One of the dreams of the 1816 Farmington Quaker Meeting House, once we get the building established and open to the public as a museum, is to work with our sister organizations, Ganondagan, Susan B. Anthony House, Granger Homestead in Canandaigua, to name a few, to develop curriculum resources. As someone who was born and brought up and educated in the Finger Lakes, I'm ashamed to say that the most I knew going through school about Native American history, even though it was surrounding me, and I would go out with my dad to look for arrowheads in the Bristol Hills, I learned about General Sullivan clearing the land for European American settlers. Mm-hmm. We learned a little bit about African American rights. There was a paragraph about Harriet Tubman and the Underground Railroad. I didn't know about Frederick Douglass and his North Star newspaper until I lived in Philadelphia in an urban land trust where one of our houses was named North Star because we were honoring that rich tradition of working toward equality and justice. There is so much to learn and to be learned. And a reason that this project is so exciting to me is that we're uncovering connections that we didn't know existed between all of these concerns and fights for equality. I often quote Holly Neer, who says in her concerts, "All the isms are connected." I think all of the struggles for peace and justice and human rights are connected, and to me, that's a lot of what we're working on at the Farmington Meeting House.
Thank you. Could I, in that vein, could I just mention a bit about Farmington and the Seneca Falls Convention? Because that was the other big thing. Everyone associates Elizabeth Cady Stanton with organizing the convention, and she certainly was the spark plug, the catalyst. But the people who helped her organize it were all Quakers, all Quakers. And the single biggest religious group who went to the Seneca Falls Convention were Quakers affiliated with the Farmington Meeting House. We have several houses of people in that area who are not only underground Railroad abolitionist sites, but also went to the Seneca Falls Convention. And Elizabeth Cady, in 1848, Quakers at Farmington split apart into those who were really upset that these reformers were working so much with the world's people and the reform-minded Quakers who formed a group called the Congregational Friends. By 1852, Elizabeth Cady Stanton writes the funniest letter. She goes to the Episcopal Church in Seneca Falls, and she says, "Yes, I do go, because my boys like the fact the minister wears a dress, and I like to sit and listen to the music for an hour. But I would consider it petty larceny, as if I'd been accused of petty larceny, to join. I couldn't join because of my women's rights ideas and my religious ideas. I consider myself a member of the Congregational Friends." And she spoke in the meeting house October 6, 1848, and she wrote that speech down on blue paper, and she tied it with a blue ribbon, and she gave it to her daughters, and she said, "This is my legacy to you. This is all I knew at the time about women's rights," and it still exists. We still have that speech. It's just, who knew?
Well, Joel writes to the program, and Joel has taught on a number of, I think, related issues, and says, "Place-based education is key." And I'm curious to know what you all, how you feel about that the value of place-based education. Go ahead, Meg.
At Canandaigua State Historic Site, we welcome groups almost on a daily basis of students from all over our county as well as surrounding counties to learn firsthand what life was like for the Seneca and Haudenosaunee people during the 1600s. They were sophisticated agriculturalists. We have 15 exhibits there that are hands-on, interactive, as well as a full-size Seneca Bark Longhouse replica. So students are taught and engaged by interpreters who are Seneca and Haudenosaunee. So not only do they get to learn about the history and culture, but they also become aware of the sovereignty and the fact that the Seneca and Haudenosaunee are contemporary people. So I think what I hear when friends of mine or family members come for the first time to Canandaigua is they have no idea what sovereignty even means. When they see the Iroquois National Exhibit and learn about the fact that the Haudenosaunee carry their own passport, it's just mind-blowing to them. And it's really important, I think, being there because, you know, as adults even, we can read about that, but it doesn't have an impact. But actually being there and seeing those young, you know, kids who, you know, were stuck, you know, not being able to get to England to play a game that they've been, you know, working for, you know, all their life, and to say, no, we're going to stick to our passport and not go on a U.S. passport for the principle of it, to support our sovereignty, it's pretty remarkable. So, yeah, I'm a big proponent. And as a former educator, I can say that when I was able to take my students places, they remembered it.
Ronnie, what do you think?
At the site, we get visitors from all over the world, and it's remarkable the similarities that we hear about. But one of the things that I always tell the groups when I'm with them or our visitors is that I am conveying my history as a Seneca woman, but this is the local history of this area. I had one person from, I believe it was Australia, years ago that I was talking to in the Longhouse, and he had a lot of interesting questions. But the first one was, well, why did you plop the Longhouse down here on this hill? Being from outside of the country, and he had no historical anything to go on, I had to explain to him that it's there because it was a Seneca village on that hilltop. And here we are, the schools that visit us, this is the local history. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that I convey to them is that, yes, we have survived and we are a contemporary people, mm-hmm. and we are still dealing with many of the same issues.
Well, and we're down to about our last minute here. So ideally, the 1816 Farmington Quaker Meeting House is going to be one of those place-based education sites. But if you want to go out, October 22nd and 23rd, there are events celebrating 200 years. It is farmingtonmeetinghouse.org for information. Is it easy? Is there a map on there? How do they, people who have been there need to get there, Lyle. So how do they find you?
Pumpkin Hook is not big on the Atlas, that's for yeah. sure. But County Road 8 and the intersection of Allen Pageant and Sheldon Roads, it's just south of the Wayne, Ontario County line. Anyone knows how to get to Victor, and it's not all that far from Victor.
Yeah, piece of cake.
Exit 44 on the thruway.
Yep.
We will underscore the beauty of place-based education all that weekend. Come and join us.
22nd and 23rd, farmingtonmeetinghouse.org for more information on what it is, the history of it, what they're trying to do with it, and that celebration that you can go attend. And you've heard about all the various events that are going to be there that weekend. And good luck to you, Lyle. Thank you for coming in and sharing the story of it and your efforts. Doing a lot of work out there, and I know a lot of people appreciate it.
It's a privilege and a pleasure. Thank you, Evan.
And thank you, Dr. Judy Willman. Great learning from you, and thank you for
you
sharing
so
your
much.
Expertise here. Great to have you. And from Get On Again, Ronnie Ryder, Meg Joseph, thank you so much. Nice talking to both of you as well.
Thank you.
And Rob Braden's the engineer. Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. And have a great afternoon. Let's talk Thursday on Member Supported Public Radio.